Congratulations. It is Friday and it is 5 p.m. Here come the weekend. Time for American Hit Radio on 90.3 WHPC. I'm your host, Tom Ryan. Lovely wife and co-host.
That's me, clearing my throat.
Here as well. Whoops. We'll be with you for the next hour. Fridays, the show topic is how music changed. We've got 250 topics lined up that we mean to cover in depth, as you can tell by our current topic, because we've been covering the music of Duke Ellington now for 14 weeks. In fact, this is week number 15 dedicated to Duke. And this is a transitional show. These are the war years when, I guess, swing music was at its peak and Ellington's band was at its peak. That's what we've been covering throughout the past couple of weeks. There have been pretty stunning shows as far as bringing on the hits. This show is very similar, but it also kind of marks the end of that era as Ellington moves into a suite of songs called Black, Brown, and Beige. We'll get to that, though, as we go deeper. But to set it up, very few people did more to ennoble and simultaneously balance America's ignorance toward the race issue than Duke Ellington. He worked so hard to be the best at what he did, and he worked equally hard to apply his own stature to his own lineage. Duke lived in the midst of prejudice and ignorance, like every black person did at that point in time. But he carried himself above the fray. His deportment spoke volumes, but his music spoke encyclopedias.
Yeah.
At this point in time, we've already heard many, many instances of Ellington writing music to emphasize his astute perspective. However, it was at this point in time where that perspective began to mature, portraying a truth that was beautiful in its presentation and undeniable in its honesty. He was never directly confrontational because he truly believed that that would be unnecessary once minds were made aware of the intrinsic value of his heritage. So that is where this will take us when we get to the Black, Brown, and Beige section. But meanwhile, in the middle, in the midst of the war years, we're talking 1942 to 1945, it's a broad era that we're covering here because that's the way that the songs saw the light. For example, we're going to feature four number one Harlem Hit Parade hits. Four of these songs went to number one in today's show.
Wow.
The first one that we're going to play is a song called Main Stem. And this is why I have to go back to 1942, because this is when Ellington put it together. And it was recorded in 1942, but for some reason it was held back until 1944. And it did go to number one on the Harlem Hit Parade. It also charted on the Billboard version of the chart. What did it chart at, you might ask me? Number 23 on the main chart. But this is Ellington at his best. I'm amazed that this song sat in the coffers for 2 years because this is a stone cold classic called Main Stem on American Hit Radio 90.3 WHPC. Thank you. You can almost hear like a little bit of a push toward what would eventually become rock and roll with songs like Mainstem, where basically, you know, you're writing on like a blue note chord pattern and, or it's just, you know, a blues chord pattern.
Okay.
And of course, you know, with upbeat jump rhythm. Definitely a sign of things to come. Now, a lot of the songs that we're going to be playing today were recorded in relatively close proximity to one another on a timeline. I've got a list here of about maybe 150 pages of Duke Ellington's discography with the songs that I wanted to feature in the show. And sometimes in one show, we could cover a year and a half, but most of these songs were recorded at a very similar time period, except for the fact that there was a strike in the middle of all of it. We'll get to that. But also from 1942 was this track called Hayfoot Strawfoot. And I wanted to find out, what's that about? Like, where does that name even come from? It turns out that there was a silent movie, a comedy from 1919 that had that title. No copies of it exist. It's lost.
Oh.
So it's rather strange, but I would imagine that Ellington was somehow familiar with it and used that for his title. The track is another song that became a hit. Not number one, but in 1942, Hayfoot Strawfoot went to number 10 on the Harlem Hit Parade. So here then is that exact track. Hayfoot Strawfoot on American Hit Radio, 90.3 WHPC. And say hello to Ivy Anderson. Called Hayfoot Strawfoot, and as I said, recorded in 1942, and it was released in that year as well. Moving forward, this is yet another of the. This is one of the other number one songs on the Harlem Hit Parade. It's a song called "Sentimental Lady."
Actually remember that song.
Okay, good. The thing is, there's so many songs that share the title. I wonder if you're thinking of the right Sentimental Lady.
Oh, maybe not.
Like not Bob Welch or anything like that. But this features Johnny Hodges on alto sax. And this also was recorded in 1942, but became a hit a year later. Actually, we'll give the exact time frame here. Yeah, later in 1943. Now, there was a reason why this was happening. At the time, in 1942, Duke Ellington heard the talk about the AFM strike, the American Federation of Musicians, where they were going to prevent members from performing or having their recordings played on the radio, because they think that they deserve to be paid for that. So they were going to put a ban on it. Ellington was aware of this, and he got a couple of recordings made in advance so that he could continue to release singles, even though they weren't going to be getting airplay.
Ah.
So it was probably somehow related to the impending strike. This song came out, and as I said, it was number one, although it was very difficult to get airplay at all at this point in time because of the AFM strike. But from as far as like recording in mid-1942, and as far as when it was a hit, it was late 1943, Sentimental Lady on American Hit Radio, 90.3 WHPC. Beautiful song called Sentimental Lady by Duke Ellington and his orchestra, and his famous orchestra. Now,
they were famous before they were famous.
They were all somewhat famous in their own right. And this now, we come to the end of what I would say is probably the most important era of Duke's career, because this next track will be the last track that we play featuring Ben Webster on saxophone. It was great having Ben in the band. I mean, he was astounding player. In a way, you could also imagine the patience that it took for the other players. I mean, you hear how brilliant Johnny Hodges is on that previous track. It may be telling that that song featured Johnny Hodges rather than Ben Webster at this point in time. because Ben was to leave after this recording session with this next track called A Slip of the Lip Can Sink a Ship on American Hit Radio, 90.3 WHPC, a war song.
Don't talk too much. Don't know too much, Jack. Don't be too hip, cause a slip of the lip might sink a ship. Don't see too much, boy. Don't jive too much, Jack. Don't be so hip, cause a slip of the lip might sink a ship. The walls have ears, the night has eyes. So let's be wise and trick those nasty Nazi spies. Shh, don't talk too much. Shh, don't know too much, boy. Don't be too hip, cause a slip of the lip might sink a ship. Just to be loquacious. Sink a ship.
Somewhat sadly, that marks the end of the what you would call the Blanton Webster years. Aww. With Jimmy Blanton and Ben Webster driving the Duke Ellington Orchestra to new heights. That track, Slip of the Lip Can Sink a Ship, was the third of our number one hit parade songs, Harlem Hit Parade songs, featured in this show. Just like I said, this is just like an endless series of what were hits at the time. And that featured Ray Nance, not only playing the trumpet solo, but that was also him on vocal, which is always cool when the musicians sing, because have like a sort of a...
It's like a hidden talent.
Yeah, and it's like, I don't know, they have a cooler delivery. They have like a hipper way of delivering. A lot of times, like the singers who are really doing nothing but singing usually sound a lot stiffer and a little bit more cardboard like. So when the musicians step up, there's like a natural flow to it.
Oh yeah.
This next track wasn't a hit, but it's another one that dates back to this time all the way to 1937 with lyrics. And this is sort of what I'm talking about, like when you get like a professional singer. Compare the way Ray Nance sounded on the previous track with the way Al Hibbler sounds here. Now, Al was Duke's go-to guy for male vocals, and he had remained there for a good decade. So this is nothing to speak against Al, because he's got really good vocal control. But I just kind of like the hip edge that comes out when a guy like Ray Nance sings, and it makes for an interesting comparison. So here with Al Hibbler on vocals is the Duke Ellington and his famous orchestra with I Ain't Got Nothing But the Blues.
Got the change of a nickel. Ain't got no bounce in my shoe. Ain't got no fancy to tickle. I ain't got nothing but the blues. Ain't got no coffee that's perky. Ain't got no winnings to lose. Ain't got a dream that is working. I ain't got nothing but the blues. When trumpets flare up, I keep my hair up. I just can't make it come down. Believe me, Pappy, I can't get happy since my ever-loving baby left town. Ain't got no rest in my slumber. Ain't got no feelings to brew. Ain't got no telephone number. I ain't got nothing but the blues. I ain't got nothing but the blues.
Now, this is the point where we take a pretty big jump through time.
To the future?
Well, the future of 1942. the AFM strike happened. It set in. And it's rather remarkable. Since I'm really focusing this, I didn't want to pick up old radio transcripts and be playing them over the air, I think, because the sound isn't that great. But for the entirety of 1943, Duke Ellington was no longer going into recording studios and making records, because the whole idea of playing recorded music on the radio was verboten. couldn't do it. It was really the exact opposite of radio silence, in a sense, because what had to happen now was, like, live music on radio was okay.
Oh.
So Duke immediately booked himself up for the entirety of 1943 into 1944, well into 1944. He's like recording broadcasting his live performances over the radio twice weekly. He had an engagement at a place called the Hurricane Room and a whole variety of different hotels. And this is how he made a living now, doing his live broadcasts. Now, I've got a printout here, Heidi. As you can see, it goes for 132 pages listing everything that Duke did day by day, his recordings that are somehow available or collectible. And here we are now at the point of, say, August of 1942, where there's a recording session and it stops. We then go from the remainder of 1942 with nothing but broadcasts, the entirety of 1943 with nothing but broadcasts. And it was during those broadcasts in 1943 when Ellington lost Ben Webster. And then into 1944. For most of 1944, the same thing. Broadcast, broadcast, broadcast. It's rather astounding that this would happen. And it wasn't until December of 1944 that Duke ended up back in the studio where he recorded this next song, which became our fourth. Well, no, it was not number one. Excuse me. This was a number four hit for the Harlem Hit Parade. A song called I'm Beginning to See the Light, written, credited to Duke Ellington and Johnny Hodges, with, of all people, Harry James getting credit for this, some of the songwriting here. As I said, it was recorded in December of 1944, and it became a hit on the Harlem Hit Parade in early 45. It's called I'm Beginning to See the Light on American Hit Radio, 90.3 WHPC. Classy Ivy Anderson vocal there.
Yes.
Duke Ellington Band. Let's play two more back-to-back here. The first up is actually a remake. We played this song earlier as Concerto for Cootie, the original instrumental version, and it was re-released in 1944 with vocals as Do Nothing Till You Hear From Me, and went on to become our fourth number one Harlem Hit Parade hit of this show. And we'll follow that up with a track that is called Don't You Know I Care? And then we'll get into Black, Brown, and Beige. On American Radio 90.3 WHPC, here's Do Nothing Till You Hear From Me.
Thank you.
do nothing till you hear from me. Pay no attention to what's said. Why people tear the seam of anyone's dream is over my head. Do nothing till you hear from me. At least consider our romance. If you should take the word of others you heard, I haven't a chance. True, I've been seen with someone new, but does that mean that I've been untrue? Though we're apart, the words in my heart reveal how I feel about you. Some kiss may cloud my memory, and other arms may hold a thrill. But please do nothing till you hear it from me. And you never will.
Hibbler featured on both of those tracks, Don't You Know I Care, and do nothing till you hear from me. But now we hit something rather unusual. We come to the black, brown, and beige era. Now, last week, we discussed the show that Ellington was involved in called Jump for Joy. It was an all-black show that satirized racism. It was based mostly in California, and it was almost certainly could have been bound for Broadway, but there was just too much limitation on an all-black cast with all-black writers and everything else. So Ellington is now, though, he thought that was the coolest thing he ever did in his entire life. He loved it. So now he's composing a piece of music about the same thing, and it ends up becoming 45 minutes long, called Black, Brown, and Beige. And he decided that he was going to put on a show at Carnegie Hall emphasizing this piece, 45 minutes of music. It's basically an album before albums existed. That's what he did. I'll be reading a little bit from Harvey Cohen's book called Duke Ellington's America. The William Morris Agency and RCA backed Ellington's extended composition, Black, Brown, and Beige, which programmatically documented African-American history with the biggest publicity campaign ever recorded an African-American artist until that time. But they and other investors balked at the sentiments, however true and humorously expressed, that were found in the previous show, Jump for Joy. By engaging in a production that openly revolted against the traditional signposts of prejudice, Ellington traversed farther than most of the country would allow him to go, despite the cultural capital that he accumulated over the years. So, it was as of this date, January 23rd, 1943, the most publicized night of Ellington's career. The orchestra appeared in its first concert at Carnegie Hall before a racially mixed, celebrity-filled, standing-room-only audience that included First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt, conductor Leopold Stokowski, soprano Marian Anderson, poet Langston Hughes. In the weeks preceding, stories about the event ran prominently in several national publications. The highlight of the evening was the premiere of Ellington's longest extended work, Black, Brown, and Beige, a tone parallel to the history of Negroes in America. A composition in three movements meant to illustrate the story of Black Americans from their abduction from Africa to their role in World War II. With this event, Ellington used the music business power at his disposal, as well as the patriotic sentiments swirling around American engagement in World War II, to place the subject of Black respectability, pride, and history into the national consciousness even more fully than he had done before. The concert further solidified his reputation as a serious composer who created works outside of the usual popular music experience and as a historical figure whose journey evinced a transformative effect on America's racial and cultural landscape. The opening track, the drum motif, repeated throughout the piece and representing what was called the work song portion of the Black movement, probably symbolizes the African origins of American slaves. The opening image of the script details a message shot through the jungle by drums, like a tom-tom in steady precision. It's a steady tom-tom pattern that opens Black, Brown, and Beige. Here is Work Song on American Hit Radio, 90.3 WHBC. gorgeous piece of music there is called Come Sunday, a day that obviously where Ellington would be conveying like the religious, the Christian aspect of Blacks in America with that track. And before that, we heard Work Song. Now, to say that Ellington put his blood, sweat, and tears, and he dedicated his entire life to Black, Brown, and Beige for at this point in time would be an understatement. He not only wrote 45 minutes worth of music, but he wrote a scenario to accompany it.
Wow.
That would more or less describe what every note, more or less, how it could be interpreted, exactly what he was trying to convey.
That's incredible.
But he began to think about it in terms of saying, maybe that's a little bit too much.
Too cranial?
Well, with the lesson that he learned from Jump for Joy is like, maybe try not to cram things down their throat. Let people get their own impressions. Let the music do what it's supposed to do. So he withheld the scenario. He didn't even let people know that it existed. And then
Crazy. The
show happens, 45 minutes, and the critical reviews came out and they panned it.
Huh.
It was really because, I mean, they basically, in one sitting, how do you take in 45 minutes of music? But so that was the major, I see that as the major problem. You hear something once and you kind of miss the point. It happened to Gershwin when he did Rhapsody in Blue. The first time he performed it, the critics didn't get it. It takes multiple listens for you to understand it.
Or to sink in.
And the other problem is, of course, Ellington is a swing band leader. And now he's putting together all these pieces that are now not 3 minutes in length, but 4.5 minutes in length, album side. And the tempo's changing all the time in order to convey the various different moods that he needs to convey. So Ellington ultimately makes the decision after doing all of this work and putting the show on at Carnegie Hall that he's not even going to record and release the entire thing. What we've got here are 4 excerpts from Black, Brown, and Beige that he did record. We heard 2 of them. We'll play one more for this show and we'll close next week with it. But this is again from Harvey Cohen's Duke Ellington's America. Ellington's Black, Brown, and Beige scenario, the written script, and the song emotions and opinions it betrayed never became public and never had a chance to influence the public debate one way or the other. In an interview with the BBC in 1972, Ellington seemed to regret the loss of this opportunity when he publicly acknowledged the existence of the scenario for the only time of his career. Of course, the script itself is more interesting than the music, he said. I think the music's pretty good, the interviewer replied. Ellington chuckled and quietly said, yeah. He sounded disappointment, an emotion he rarely indulged in when speaking with the media. Ellington himself wondered if the message about the need for equal rights exclusively through the medium of music was sufficient, given the scale of the problems and suffering he had witnessed and endured. He apparently also struggled with the issue of how effective the messages were that he placed programmatically and emotionally within his compositions. Was he being too timid? Did his insistence on staying within the musical realm only play into old stereotypes that viewed music as one of the few areas in which Blacks were skilled?
Mm-hmm.
Had he penned musical tributes to Burt Williams and Bojangles rather than more radical, political, and violent Blacks such as Frank Douglass or Nat Turner only to keep his position in society? With Black, Brown, and Beige, which encapsulated his lifetime interest in Black history, Ellington seems to have arrived at a personal crossroads, and at the end of his scenario, he appeared concerned and somewhat haunted that he may have chosen the wrong path. It's a shame. It's a masterful piece of work. We'll leave you now with a track called The Blues, and hope you have a great weekend, and hope you're going to join us next Friday as we continue. Take care, everybody. From Duke Ellington and his famous orchestra, Black, Brown, and Beige performance, here is a track called The Blues. Take care now.
The blues, the blues ain't, the blues ain't nothing. The blues ain't nothing but a cold gray day, and all night long it stays there. that way. Ain't something that leaves you alone. Ain't nothing I want to call my own. Ain't something with sense enough to get up and go. Ain't nothing like nothing I know. The blues, the blues don't, the blues don't know. The blues don't know nobody as a friend. Ain't been nowhere where they're welcome back again. No ugly, mean blue.
The blues ain't the